Call the Senate Housing and Homelessness Prevention Committee to order. We are running a little late because floor went over, so we are going to move Senate File 2233 to next week and move directly to Senate File 1929. Senator Umover Baton. 1298, sorry. I can read numbers. Senator Umover Baton, if you want to sort of introduce your bill and do the big amendment, and then we can have staff walk through that prior to testimony. Does that seem like the right order?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Umover Baton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm very excited to be back here for this bill, which once we adopt this amendment, will include several necessary reforms to ensure affordable and safe and stable housing for all. We know that stable housing leads to better health, educational, and professional outcomes for families everywhere. And I will let council read what is in the delete all amendment. It includes several bills that are being added to 1298. There's a really thorough summary. I'll be ready to answer your questions about it. And I'm going to try to be brief because there's some great folks who will testify to this importance. But you've heard me come here and talk about needing to level the playing field between tenants and landlords, the need to prohibit discrimination in housing, especially the forms of discrimination that serve as a proxy against other protected classes like race and disability and familial status. You've heard me talk about trying to avoid evictions for tenants and landlords alike. We can do that with proper notice. We can do that by giving parties time to resolve issues. We can do that by ensuring that people are aware of the resources that are available to them. And you've also heard me talk about the need to expunge eviction actions and records as laid out in this bill, just so that these records are not haunting folks for years to come and preventing them from securing housing. So I'm excited to hear from others today, but I do have the A2 amendment in front of us, which is going to put it in that package form, and if council can walk through that and then we can get a motion, we'll be able to speak to the bill in its correct form.
Senator Bolden moves the A2 amendment, and then Ms. Painter, would you please walk through the A2?
Madam Chair and members, Sections 1, 2, and 3 come from Senate File 430, which is about prohibiting discrimination of public assistance recipients. Sections 4 and 5 were from Senate File 690, expanding expungement of evictions. Section 6 comes from Senate File 556, which is about prohibiting any requirement to declaw or devocalize a pet. Section 7 is from Senate File 819, prohibiting certain fees. Section 8 is from Senate File 429, relating to eviction notices. Section 9 is Senate File 1091, limiting early renewals. Section 10 is Senate File 821, remedies for repairs. Let's see. Sections 11 and 12 and 13 come from Senate File 2031, which we heard on Tuesday. Section 14 is from Senate File 1091, rights to inspections, also Section 15. Section 16 and 17 came from Senate File 819, changing the landlord entry specifications. Section 18 was from Senate File 98, the right to counsel in public housing eviction actions. Section 19 is from 19, 20, and 21. Sections 19 and 20 came from Senate File 1298. And section 21 was from both Senate File 1298 and Senate File 429, amending eviction proceedings. Sections 22 through 30 are all from Senate File 1298, amending eviction proceedings. And the remaining sections are from Senate File 821, relating to remedies for repairs.
Thank you, Ms. Painter. Members, questions on the amendment before we adopt it? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Uma Verbaten, would you like to do your other amendments? Would you like to go to testimony? Which do you prefer?
Madam Chair, we could do the next two, since there are pieces that were just sort of left out of this A2 amendment. The A3 amendment is ensuring that the penalties were included on the prohibited fees section. So,
thank you, Senator Umu Verbaten. Senator Muhammad moves the A3 amendment. Members, any questions about this? This should be in your packets. Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Umu Verbaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the A4 amendment is regarding the section on source of income protection. It was formerly Senate File 430. I've had conversations with the Department of Human Rights to ensure that this language is in line with their statute. So it's just sort of amending what was in that first page of the A2 amendment to ensure that folks cannot be discriminated against based on their participation in or requirements of housing assistance program. And I will just note that the on page 3 of this amendment, it does lay out the exception for an owner-occupied space. There was some discussion about that in committee before. I can go into that in more detail if you'd like me to, but that was already provided for in the Department of Human Rights statute. So this is the right way to present that bill.
Thank you, Senator Move Verbaten. Senator Bolden moves the A4 and to discussion, members. I will just say thank you, Senator Umu Verbaten, for continuing to fight for this. You moved me in this process, and I appreciate that. So appreciate your continued work on it to get it right. With that, all in favor of the A4, say aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Senator Umu Verbaten. Senator Muhammad.
Chair, Senator Umu Verbaten, I have the A5 amendment.
Senator Muhammad moves the A5.
Give this to Liz.
This is part of the...
Senator Muhammad.
This is part of the bill that was moved yesterday, and I know parts of it are included in this mini omnibus version, and I want to make sure that it's included in it. This is part of the housing equity bill this session. It is important to me and the folks that I represent, and I know that there were some conversations around legal aid not supporting it. They actually do not have a position on it, and I spoke to them, and so I want to make sure that at least the rest of the portions of the housing equity bill is included in this, and I would really appreciate it if Senator Umu Verbaten would accept it as a friendly amendment.
Senator Muhammad, could you just describe a little bit about what your amendment does?
Yeah, so there are three sections. The first section is, it's the 2031 bill. The first section is a termination of lease upon income. The other part is the tenant amendment dwelling version, and then we have the effective date. And Larry McDowell is also in the room if anybody has any questions. If there are parts of the bill or parts of this amendment people are not comfortable with, like the timeline, the date, happy to accept friendly amendments on that as well.
Senator Umu-Verbaeten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm comfortable accepting this as a friendly amendment.
Discussion or questions, members? Senator Draham.
Thank you. I guess my first question for the author of the E5, and I touched on this a little bit in committee the other day, but the lost income. And my two examples were, one, if there was a snow day this week and someone missed a shift, is that lost income? And my second example was maybe a someone working overtime and then decides not to work overtime. By this vague language in here, I would think they both would apply. So we're just wondering how you interpret the way this is drafted.
Senator Mohammed.
Chair Bolden, Senator Draham, that's a good question. The way I translate it for myself is that it's if somebody loses their job. And Larry, do you want to go more detail into that?
Senator Draham.
I guess maybe we should ask counsel. In statute, how would this be interpreted? Because the way I interpret it has lost income. Is very vague, and when you have vague laws, they can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. I apologize, I know this is not your primary area, but I would like some thoughts on it, and if we want to go to the testifier then come back, that'd be great too.
We will come back to council. Mr. McDonough.
Thank you. As I read the bill, you have the combination of the lost income and can no longer pay the rent. And so just because someone's income fluctuated, it still has to be connected with not being able to pay the rent. In terms of ambiguity, you know, I've been a landlord-tenant practitioner for a long time. In the security deposit statute, there's the concept of ordinary wear and tear. And so one could say, well, that's ambiguous. How can we figure it out? And it's been working fine ever since it was passed in, I think, 1978.
Senator Draham, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to pull up 504B-152 and see what that says. But if we could go to council and get their interpretation, I would appreciate that as I search for this current statute.
Ms. Painter?
Madam Chair and members, I'm not sure that I can come up with a really good answer to your question. I think it's a good question. I think it's reasonable to interpret that if the tenant has lost income and can no longer pay the rent, would mean that both of those clauses would need to apply, as the testifier said. But without more time, I don't think I can give you a larger answer than that.
Senator Draham.
Thank you. And I guess that's kind of my point, that it's really vague. And who decides what is lost income and can no longer pay rent? I mean, if I just oppose the whole amendment, and I urge all members to vote no.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in my time in the legislature here, it's almost been a decade, when there are ambiguous terms in a bill or in an amendment that's brought forward, it's not up to the opinions of testifiers or proponents or opponents to define or clarify what ambiguous language is. It's up to the member that's offering it. So with that, I'm very concerned that lost income is not defined and no longer able to pay rent is not defined. It's very ambiguous. So is that no longer able to pay rent expected rent? What can I do or what does a tenant have to do or a landlord have to do to verify that? There's no verification in here. Is it just based on the word of the tenant? Is it based on any other validation from an employer? What if they're self-employed? I already brought up the examples of the seasonal There's none of that in here. And it doesn't say lost job. It doesn't say that. It says lost income. It doesn't say unemployed. It just says has lost income. And so my question, Madam Chair, and to the author of the amendment, what exactly, can you please, as you wrote this amendment, what exactly does lost income mean?
Senator Mohammed.
Senator Lucero, it means if somebody loses their job. So if you want to define it as lost of a job, lost of however it is that would translate better for you or for other folks, that's fine with me. But the intent of it is to say, per se, I lost my job today and I don't have a job or a way to pay for my for rent. I don't want to be evicted because I don't want that to be on my record, because that rarely gets off people's records. Then somebody, I can go ahead and provide a written statement to my landlord and say, I no longer have a job or income, therefore I need to move out within 14 days.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so what about somebody who's self-employed? So I have tenants right now that are self-employed. They cut grass and they do landscaping. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have a job. They're self-employed. So how would that work? How would, as you just described, loss of job, how does that work in the context of self-employed?
Senator Mohammed.
Senator Bolden, for folks who are self-employed, often, let's say they're cutting grass, they have contracts, right? Like they're contracting with other people so that they could do this work and they get paid for it. If somebody let's say somebody does seasonal contracting work and they, I don't know, shovel snow, let's make that for an example. And the only way they're able to pay for rent is through that in the winter, in the summer they do something else, then I think that like it can be defined on what exactly, maybe like what if somebody loses income because they no longer have a job, that is whether somebody works for somebody else or is working for themselves and they no longer have contracts and or income coming in. If you don't have income coming in and you're renting a space, the goal of it is for you to give notice to your landlord and say, I will no longer have income to be able to pay for this rent.
Madam Chair.
Senator Umu Verbaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I see this as friendly. I am very grateful to all the authors who have trusted me to carry the bills that they originally brought forward to place into this larger package. And this was an important piece of Senate file 2031, if I have that number right. This entire package will need to go forward to Judiciary next, where we'll continue to dig into these definitions. But I also wanted to give Mr. McDonough an opportunity to respond.
Mr. McDonough.
Madam Chair, there are other types of income that can be lost that would inform this conversation. So, for instance, I have an adult daughter with special needs. She has SSI disability benefits. If she were to lose those benefits, that would be the same as losing a job or losing a seasonal contract. So the reason for choosing lost income rather than to define all the different possible categories of income that someone could lose, and that certainly could be done, but by using the term lost income, it takes all those into account.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think that even goes more to my point. There are all kinds of income. It's not just job. And there are many incomes that are losses or reductions are anticipated to occur, and there are some that are unexpected. But with the incredibly vague language here, even those anticipated reductions in seasonal income or overtime hours would qualify for this, and a tenant could abuse this clause right here and get themselves out of a contract for any other reason. And they could use this as an excuse, and that's my concern. Here's another item. Earlier, when we spoke about this, I think it was last Friday, on line 1.15, there's an enactment date or effective date, August 1st of 2023. So I haven't, I guess I didn't do the math. What are we, we're, let's just say March 1st, so we're approximately five months, I'm just doing the quick math, if that's right, it's 5-6 months. So there are people, there are tenants and housing providers that are in contracts right now that they, both parties entered into a mutually agreed upon written contract without this. And this, if the ability to break a contract, if that was known upon entering into a mutually agreed upon contract, that would have potentially changed the terms. I certainly know it would have changed the terms for me because it increases the risk. So what do you say to those housing providers who are not, who are now in a contract for 12 months, 24 months, or 3 months or more? Long-term contracts with residential tenant that are now, they can't fact, I guess, so let me ask it this way. I'll ask you this. Would you be friendly to an amendment to your amendment here that would allow the housing provider to increase the rent on a contract that is in effect or was signed prior to the effective date that extends beyond the effective date? Would you be willing to accept language that allows for the housing provider to unilaterally raise that with a 14-day notice?
Senator Mohammed.
Thank you, Senator Lucero. That's a good question. No, but what I am open to is changing the date so that people have enough time to be able to know, like, for example, if they already got into a lease agreement with somebody else, that now they'll have until how long ever that needs to be for this to get into effect before they fully take it on. That I'm open to changing the date, and I'm not fully stuck on it being effective this August.
Senator Lucero.
Okay, that's all I have for now on that. I just because this wasn't posted, I'm trying to read through different questions I might have. Those are my questions on just that portion, so I'm continuing to read if others might have questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Umover-Bayton.
Part of how I see this provision is, again, you know, this package is, you know, trying to strike the right balance. I understand we're going to have disagreements here. If someone, later on, we'll see parts of the bill around not being able to pay rent and being in the situation where you're then facing an eviction. I feel like what I see Senator Mohammed trying to bring forward here is giving tenants opportunity to say, I don't want to be in the position where I can't afford to pay my rent. I want to tell you, I want to give you an opportunity to maybe find someone else who can, you know, come into this space and pay this rent so you're not losing that. Otherwise, we're going to go down the route of me not paying the rent, not paying the rent, not paying the rent, and you're going to have to move forward with an eviction. That's the only other course of action that you have. So this is giving that tenant an opportunity to try to be proactive and avoid a situation where they're not able to pay and the landlord is not able to receive, you know, the money that they need.
Senator Mohammed Bolden.
And, you know, the other part of it is often when somebody loses a job, like, you know, they'll be like, you're done effective today. And some often, actually, a lot of times those folks are told, we'll pay you for the next 2 weeks and then you're gone, right? So now they have 14 days that they know at least they'll have some sort of income and they can work it out. And they can go to their landlord and say, like, hey, I lost my job. I no longer have income. Exactly what Senator Umover-Bayton said. I have 14-day, like, I'm giving you a 14-day notice to release myself of this stress when they already don't have a job. And often the people who most struggle with this are BIPOC people. That's why this is the equity bill. And that's why I want to make sure it's not left out of the our tenant omnibus bill, because we're updating our tenant laws for the first time in decades. And I want to make sure that people of color are reflected in this. And I hear most about this issue on folks who live in Cedar Riverside, which is not a part of my district, but it is the largest immigrant folks in probably the state of Minnesota. And they're the ones who are like, oh, lost my job. I'm stuck on this lease. Like, my brother was affected by this. That's why this is important to me to include it.
Okay, I have a couple members on the list. I also, given that the organization was invoked, Legal Aid, and I see Mr. Elwood from Legal Aid, I wonder if you would have a response or want to come and share the perspective of your organization since you were invoked in some earlier comments. And please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Ron Elwood, and Representative Bolden, I'm sorry, could you repeat what you'd like me to comment upon?
Yes. Given that in earlier parts of the discussion, it was your organization was invoked and that you were neutral on the bill and didn't have concerns, and it was referenced that maybe some people had heard that there were concerns from Legal Aid around this provision, and so I just wondered if you could clarify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Bolden. You know, this is not our provision. This is not wasn't our bill. You know, if we are asked for an observation on the language, we're happy to do that. We don't support it or not support it. It's not our bill. So I didn't, you know, I could just say, I mean, this, you, do you want just the just this section one of the, or section one of this amendment or the whole amendment? What are you asking me? I'm sorry.
The amendment in its entirety, I guess, is what I was asking about. But if you'd like to comment on just this section at this time.
This section of the amendment?
That would be fine. Yep.
You know, I mean, I think... I think some of the points that were raised about clarifying the language would probably be really useful. You know, typically, when Legal Aid is involved in kinds of these things, typically we try to vet things and talk about what the concerns might be and try to find common ground and that kind of thing. But this, again, this wasn't our bill, so I really feel it appropriate to kind of comment on the substance.
Understood. That's fine. Just as you were invoked, I wanted to give you the opportunity, so I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll move. I've got some members. So Port, Dreheim, and then Lucero. Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there is merit in these ideas. I think there are important conversations to be had as part of them. In the crafting of this tenants bill, which has gone on over the course of the session, as we've heard these bills, it has been an effort on my part to have good faith negotiations with the authors, with the advocates, and also with the landlords. I have this portion in this amendment has not been a part of those conversations that I have had. On either side until just yesterday. And so at this point, I haven't had a chance to get feedback, to talk about implementation, to talk about what this would look like. And so I am not comfortable moving this amendment forward at this time. But I am committed to continuing the conversations on these. I think they are important provisions, but I do think there have been some real questions raised that we are probably not, we probably haven't spent the time necessary on it to move them forward. And so for that reason, I'm a no on this amendment, but I am supportive of continuing to have this conversation. And next year, we have a whole policy year, which is entirely built around housing policy. And I'm very, very willing to continue this conversation.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair. And I the author of this amendment, I would recommend that there be a couple tweaks if you are really going to move forward with this concept, which I hope you don't. One, the next one to me, we talked about the income and the vagueness of that. The next one would be on 1.9 on the 14-day written notice. In the rural parts of the state, 14 days is not enough time for us to get mail. It is. I have gone well over a week without having the mailman stop at my mailbox. And I have a whole bunch of entities run out of my house. I get tons of mail. The probability of me not getting mail in a single day is almost zero, not counting all the packages that come to the house. So 14 days, if you're going to move forward with this, I think you need to reevaluate the date. Be a lot easier just to not offer the amendment. And then on the effective date, you know, to me, I think you'd run into some legal problems with existing contracts. So if you're going to do it, you probably should have any lease written after X date and not the way it is right now. With that, I still urge you to withdraw your amendment and work on it for next year. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go to Senator Lucero, and then we're going to vote on the amendment so we can continue to move forward and hear about the rest of the bill. So, Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then another comment, as I'm reading this, line 1.17, and I won't spend a lot of time because I appreciate Chair Port's remarks. The word abandoned, there needs to be specification if this were to come back in another form. What exactly does that mean? Because I have language in leases right now that when a tenant leaves for greater than 7 days, if they're expecting to do that, for whatever reason, vacation, something, to let me know. Because if something happens to the property and the furnace breaks and, you know, it's in the middle of winter, I want to avoid potential freeze damage, things like that. But they may forget to notify me. And or maybe there's a friction in the relationship for whatever reason, completely separate from anything in this amendment, that the communication is strained, and they may be absent from the property. Maybe they've gone on maybe they're traveling out of state for 3 weeks, for example. And if I have no communication whatsoever in my attempts to reach out to them, I don't know if they've abandoned it or not. When do I begin to exercise these steps as required to begin to rent it out, right? It's just there's ambiguity there, and again, it's an overall theme of, I do understand the intent, but there's a lot of ambiguity, and in order for contract law, and I am not a lawyer, but in my interactions with lawyers, they've always said you got to be very clear, especially when it comes to contract law. What are the definitions? What are the expectations? So that there isn't this ambiguity on both parties that are in the contract. So thank you again, Madam Chair.
Final word, Senator Muhammad, and then we will vote.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll ask for a roll call on the vote. But
roll call requested, roll call granted. Senator Muhammad.
Okay, great, thank you. You know, I thought about pulling this out. I thought about not including in it. And, you know, I don't just get to represent the people of 63, even though I would love to. I represent a broader coalition and people who are reflective of my experience and of who I am and who look to me every day and say, you need to do better. And some don't speak English. A lot of them don't. And to me, I think of everything from an equity perspective. I cannot think about having to update our tenant laws without thinking about it from an equity perspective. This is the equity bill this session. And we're choosing only parts of it to include because we're uncomfortable with some of the language. Tell me the parts that you're uncomfortable with. I'm happy to work with you, Senator Draham. To your question, 14-day mark for rural Minnesota, that's too long for them to not be able to get a mill. That is a fair perspective. Happy to work with you to change that language. This whole thing goes to judiciary next. We don't have to pull parts of the bill. This is the equity bill. We should include every part of it. And I'll say it. That's why we elected the first Black woman in the Senate for the first time, because we think from this perspective, because this matters to us. And this might not be like a big thing for people, and they might be like, this is going to change, you know, laws around lease agreements, and I'm not an attorney. If somebody is happy to work with you, if somebody wants to change parts of this, happy to work with you. But to introduce a bill, to get a hearing, and the only time I have people have issues with it is like days, hours before, and I don't get enough time as the chief author to be able to work it out with you, and my option is to pull it, is not an option for the people I represent. So I will ask all of you to vote yes, and if there are parts of this that you want to work together to change as it moves through committees, I'm more than willing and open to work with you. Thank you.
Okay, so now I'm seeing many hands. Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I make a motion for the roll call to be placed in the Senate Journal, please?
I believe we need three hands for that. Motion has been made to put the roll call in the Senate Journal. It is. Request to have the roll call placed in the Senate Journal. So I believe we need three hands for that. Are there three hands? One, two, three, yes. So we'll be placed in the journal. Senator Housley, did you have other comments? No. Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to the remarks from the author of the amendment, of willingness to open, I believe, so this, it's not ours before. I think we heard this, the similar language, obviously, to the original bill back on Friday. And so there was a lot of concern expressed by testifiers, by members of the committee, and our doors have been open. My door has been open. Nobody's reached out to me to talk about the concerns, how we might be able to incorporate any of those concerns into this amendment. And my door is still open all year round. This is an important issue, and I definitely want to get it right. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Umer-Verbeaten.
If there's committee members that still want to speak to it, I totally understand. I just wanted to offer up some additional comments as the author of the package. And happy to work with you, Senator Lucero. I hear your comments, Senator Dreheim. One of the things that I see this kind of matching up with is the 14-day pre-eviction notice. If that needs to be longer, I'm open to that as well, to ensure that people are able to receive notice in time if there's issue with mail. You all did have an opportunity to hear the standalone version of this bill. And again, I appreciate all of the authors who have trusted me to carry all the components of their bill in this package. And I do see this as friendly, and I encourage you to vote to include it in the package.
Senator Dreheim, did you have other comments? Okay. Senator Pa.
Thank you. Chair Bolden, I just want to say I appreciate and I understand the intent of this bill and amendment, but I too have serious concerns about the vagueness of the loss of income. As someone who's been in the real estate industry for over 20 plus years, this does have really big impacts and it could have unintended consequences. So for me, I really would love it if we would spend more time in really thinking through this bill and this amendment and working it in a way that benefits people, but it doesn't hurt others. So I can't support this amendment at this time, but I'm more than happy to also work with the author and with this committee on working on this language to something I can support as well. I really do think that there is really huge unintended consequences with this. The vagueness of the loss of income really is something that is a concern for me. We could say something for thought later would be, is it a total loss of income? Is it a partial loss of income? To what degree of loss of income are we talking about? Because if someone's saying, I have a total loss of income, that's going to be a lot different than someone who says, you know, I've got a partial loss of income, and that qualifies. But again, these are a lot of different points in which I think there has to be more discussion on.
Okay, members. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Port?
No.
Senator Bolden?
No.
Senator Dreheim?
No.
Senator Housley?
No.
Senator Lucero?
No.
Senator Muhammad?
Yes.
Senator Pa?
No.
Senator Rest?
No.
There being seven nays and one aye, the amendment is not adopted. Senator Umar-Vaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to give the testifiers a moment to speak.
Up first on our testifiers list, I have Meg Daly. And next I have Amara Omar, if you can come up as well. Testifiers, we will keep this to 2 minutes testifying to try to get us through this bill today. Ms. Daly, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, Meg Daly. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm the advocacy manager at the Minnesota Youth Collective, an organization that was founded in 2018 to increase the governing power of young people in our state. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate File 1298, the Tenants' Rights Omnibus Bill. From Red Lake down to Red Wing, no matter what we look like or what's in our wallets, at Minnesota Youth Collective, we believe that every Minnesotan deserves a safe and stable place to call home. But we know that housing stability is a faraway dream for too many young people across our state. Today's young adults are more likely to rent their homes than older generations, and according to research from the Berkeley Institute for Young Americans, have faced the largest percent increase in rent among generations since 2002. And over the years, Minnesota Youth Collective has heard from countless young people who have struggled moving out on their own in our current economic climate and have struggled to navigate and understand their tenants' rights. Stable housing is foundational to successful outcomes for young people. Without it, we are often unable to complete education, apply for jobs, or receive other benefits. Senate File 1298 would go a long way toward improving the housing outcomes of all Minnesotans, including young people. And just to touch briefly on two parts of the package that would be particularly impactful for people in our base, common crime-free lease addendums state that proof of violation does not require a criminal conviction, meaning that a mere arrest or even a stop that results in neither arrest nor conviction could result in someone being evicted from their home. And we know that Minnesota's communities of color face disparate treatment in our criminal legal system, so setting some parameters for these lease provisions when it comes to interactions with the criminal legal system outside of the apartment premises is a step forward for racial justice in our state. Additionally, renters and landlords alike benefit from being on the same page at move-in and move-out. Requiring initial and final inspections will allow both parties to start and end the landlord-tenant relationship with clarity. We've heard numerous stories from young renters who pack up their apartments, scrub down their former homes, leave the keys behind, and then wait with bated breath, only to have major deductions made to their security deposit. Of course, this can be financially devastating for low-income renters in particular, and this bill would eliminate the guessing game and give tenants a fair chance to remedy any issues and recover their full deposit.
Conclude your testimony.
Okay, great. The federal government has recently highlighted the need to take new actions on tenant protections. It's our stance that the Tenants' Rights Omnibus Bill would do just that for renters across our state.
Thank you very much, Ms. Daly. Our next testifier is online. Ms. Omar, if you would please come off mute and turn on your camera, and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you. Dear Chair Port and members of the Senate Housing Committee, my name is Amar Omar and I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm here testifying in support of Senate File 1298 because of how it would protect the rights of tenants across the state, including student tenants. Last semester, some of my friends had decided to move in together at one of the off-campus apartments by the Twin Cities campus. As first-time renters, they didn't really know what to expect. Now, even a month after they had moved in, they all received an email requesting they submit renewal documents for the next year to secure their unit. They were worried that if they did not sign or soon enough, there would not be any other options available for them, and they felt trapped. If tenants were guaranteed at least 4 months to experience living in that unit before being asked to renew their lease, then these students would have been able to make an informed decision in a reasonable period of time. Another concern among students is the security deposit within the lease. A requirement for a mutual walkthrough at the beginning and end of the lease would prevent miscommunications between landlords and tenants. This has significant financial implications for students. One of my friends had run into this issue this year. On move-in, her unit was dirty and had visible blemishes on the walls and furniture. She would have been much more comfortable moving in if the landlord would have discussed these issues with her before the first payment. Additionally, the end of the lease walkthrough is just as important for renters. Her unit was fined over $700 for a broken shelf that she had submitted a work order for prior. Despite being told that it would be fixed while she lived there, the fine was only issued weeks after she moved out, and therefore she had no choice but to pay. If the landlord would have walked through the apartment, the issue would have been discussed and potentially fixed without tenants having to pay an unreasonable amount of money. Students should not be responsible for landlord miscommunications or faults from previous renters. The SF-1298 legislative proposal covers a wide range of issues related to tenant-landlord relationships and will provide significant benefits to tenants in Minnesota, such as rent control, eviction protection, and security deposit regulations. If passed, this bill would provide significant benefits to tenants in Minnesota, including student tenants. Rent control measures would help to ensure that rental prices remain affordable and reasonable, particularly in urban areas where rents are prohibitively high, like our campuses. Eviction protections would provide greater security for tenants, particularly those facing unexpected financial hardships or other circumstances beyond their control. And stronger deposit regulations would help to prevent tenants from landlords from unfairly withholding deposits or charging excessive fees, which would also help reduce the financial burdens that students already face. It would also ensure that students are protected from the pressures of having to renew their leases so early and create support for tenants to ensure that they are moving into a unit they are guaranteed when they sign their lease.
Ms. Omar, please conclude your testimony.
Yes, I will. Through this piece of legislation, your committee will be working to support student tenants all across Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Omar. Linda Satterstam, I believe you are also online, a virtual testifier. Please turn on your camera and come off mute.
Yes,
introduce yourself for the committee, and you may begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you so much. My name is Linda Satterstam, and I am a Section 8 voucher holder. Thank you, Chair Port. I'm here today to talk about source of income discrimination against people who carry subsidies or bridging or such as the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher. It is a federal program that pays on the first of the month two-thirds of the rent, and I pay the other third. And I would just ask that I always, as a part of the community and a contributing member of society, be offered an interview side by side with any other applicant, whether they be on a voucher or I be on a voucher. And that is essentially what I wanted to bring to your attention today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, I have you next on our list. Please come to the table, introduce yourself, and provide your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We represent 2,200 members who serve 600,000 renters who make their home in more than 300,000 rental homes provided by our members. The inclusion of mandatory Section 8 is a serious concern for several reasons, but especially because it is a mandate to property owners and managers to participate in the federal government's Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. The proposal would make non-participation a discriminatory practice. This proposal takes away a provider's current option to voluntarily participate in the program and forces the housing provider to enter into a housing assistance payment contract with the federal government administered by local housing authorities. It does this because Minnesota has a first-in-line statute that requires consideration of applications one at a time in the order they were received. Removing the housing provider's choice to opt in also removes the incentive for local housing authorities to improve their programs and be responsive to concerns. If participation is mandatory, then there is no need to fix program issues. We are also extremely disappointed to see the inclusion of the variation of the limitation on crime-free. This provision recalls the abuse of housing providers under the COVID emergency orders in 2020. The provision would prevent housing providers from evicting individuals who assault an owner, manager, or staff member off the premises of the property. This is extreme. We have submitted our testimony, and we won't cover it much further, but this provision is nothing more than protection for badly behaving residents. There is no alternative language to consider because this is a problem that does not exist. This language should be removed. We appreciate the effort to make the language about the notice of entry functional, but we're still concerned about other included provisions in the amended bill which have not have had language changes to meet the threshold of a functional statute. The vast number of changes to the law have an effective date of August 1st, which is unworkable. With over 28,000 jobs in our industry, the industry will need time to understand the law, develop training programs for their staff, and implement business processes in compliance with the law. We suggest August 1st, 2024 is an effective date. All these proposals,
Mr. Smith, please conclude your testimony.
Sure. All these proposals only reduce the vital supply of housing and increase the cost of housing. We're going in the wrong direction to solve our housing affordability challenge. I urge a no vote.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next on my list, I have Elena Nyhoff. Is Ms. Nyhoff here? Okay, I don't see her. So, Ms. Brown, Lucy Brown, is a virtual testifier. You can turn on your camera and come off mute. Please introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lucy Brown. I am president of Loopy Development Partners. We are a real estate development firm in Minneapolis focused on the urban core. My husband and I have built the business for over 35 years, specializing in affordable and student housing. I am speaking today in opposition to the bill in three areas. First, early renewal. I lovingly call myself the grandmother of student housing. I've been leasing and managing property at the U of M for a very long time. This is a solution in search of a problem. Students can and do decline to renew early, and they also seek out early housing options. We don't need a state law to fix this. In fact, the current housing system works really well to provide diverse housing in a timely manner. The entire university housing ecosystem is dependent upon a 9-month renewal cycle. This makes sure that housing is available both for new students and those leaving the dorms. In fact, in order for the U of M to successfully place incoming freshmen in dorms, the earlier they know the availability, the better. The off-campus housing community and the U of M Office of Residential Life work really well together and collaborate within the current system, which I believe prevails at most Big Ten schools. Shifting the rental timetable from October to January will simply compress the cycle, causing more disruption in what already can be a very stressful process for students and parents alike. Regarding the crime-free issue, it's already hard enough to prevent
crime. Ms. Brown, please conclude your testimony, please.
Well, okay. In that case, the bill was not crafted with any landlord input, not any of the sections whatsoever. The authors consulted tenant advocates and legal aid lawyers. The solutions offered will be so over the reach in favor of tenants that good landlords and investors will abandon the business. I believe the committee received little or no housing industry feedback. The authors really, with all due respect, have no idea what it's like to be in the trenches every day operating rental property. This bill will exacerbate, not solve, the housing crisis by driving out the good operators who really care about our residents, like Loopy Development, and curtail new investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Our final testifier is Jessica Huber. Ms. Huber is also virtual. If you would please turn on your camera and come off mute. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Huber, and I'm a senior portfolio manager for Climb & Realty for over 20 years. We are a fee management company and manage over 5,000 market rate homes in the Twin Cities area. Contrary to what you may believe, most people that own and manage apartment buildings are compassionate people. We go day to day, our day to day goes beyond collecting rent and filing for evictions. We want people to stay in their homes. In all reality, we provide homes for hundreds of thousands of people in the state of Minnesota. We wear several hats in this industry that include caregivers, security peace officers, mediators, counselors, mental health advocates, and so much more. We are empathetic, we are generous, we are involved in our communities, educated, and are always seeking ways to give back to those who we provide housing to. When I read this bill, all I see are more roadblocks and more government control. Whomever wrote this bill, where is the context coming from and why the need for change? Did you look at court cases in favor of the tenant and see an alarming percentage of landlords in the wrong? Did you look at complaints to the Attorney General's office and see a wave of rule-breaking landlords depriving the public of housing? The way I perceive this is that you, the public officials, have a housing crisis on your hands, and you think the magical fix is to force private ownership of multi-housing to take on the problems that you have with more government regulation. These proposed changes will not fix homelessness and affordable housing. In all reality, it will change the ability to finance and operate rental properties. Prohibiting the housing provider from terminating a lease for resident criminal conduct off the lease premises. Why is that any of the government's business? Why would residents abiding by their lease terms with children in a household want to live next to a resident that was convicted for drug dealing or domestic assault, theft, carjacking, or breaking and entering? Do these crimes fit the bill of your nonviolent actions that you are proposing? Why do you get to tell me I can't terminate the lease? The resident is in violation of their lease, a contract that was signed by both parties. All this is doing is allowing the bad actors to continue to live amongst residents who expect me, management, to uphold the terms of the lease they signed. I can't do that when you're restricting me as to how I'm to do my job. In a time when residents more than ever need to feel safe, you, the government, are not allowing me to do my job. If you make me have to allow these bad actors to remain housed in my buildings,
Ms. Heber, please conclude your testimony.
All right, I will. Bottom line is there's a lot going on in our industry that we deal with, homelessness being one of them. Homelessness where we have homeless people breaking and entering into our buildings, using blow torches to remove copper wiring from our buildings, hammers to break open our laundry rooms, doing drugs in the hallways as children and families are coming home to work. I urge you people in public office here to reach out and actually have conversations with landlords. If you want to create more affordable housing and end homelessness, you need to start listening to those of us that actually do this day in and day out. And let's come up with a solution together. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Umu-Verbaeten, before we go to member questions and concerns, do you have any closing comments? All right. Members, I will flag. We have this room for 40 minutes. We can stay here until 2:55. I would not like to come back tonight after caucus, but we will if we don't move this bill. So let's see if we can keep our comments concise and to the point and move through this bill. I understand it's a weighty bill, but we have also discussed all portions of it prior. So Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. And Chair Port, I don't want to come back either, so let's try to get this done. But it is an important bill, and it does affect a large segment of our housing ecosystem that we are trying to build more of. My question, I guess, has to do with the agency, and I don't see the commissioner here, but we're just wondering if we could get the comments from Dan or someone else, if they want to come in and comment on this, and then I have a follow-up after. I just want to know where they're at in support of this bill or have thoughts on it. And then I have a follow-up.
Senator Dreheim, can I ask, are there particular provisions just based on which one of them I'll call up?
We don't have time to go through all of them. But
that's
yeah,
fair.
Just a general.
Let's start with Mr. Kitzberger and see if we need additional phone a friend from there. Mr. Kitzberger, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and then we'll go back to Senator Dreheim or I guess you can give your thoughts on the bill.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the legislative director at Minnesota Housing. To your question, Senator Dreheim, our support would be, or our support in the affirmative would be limited to the provisions that have overlap with those that have been introduced as part of governor's policy bills. We would be neutral on other parts of the bill.
Senator Dreheim?
Thank you. I really don't have any more to add to for the agency, but I guess the way the bill's drafted, I would think there would be a fiscal impact to the state and to local communities. And I guess I would ask the author, is there a fiscal note on this bill?
Senator Umover-Bayton.
Madam Chair, Senator Dreheim, I believe those were requested for all of the individual bills, but I don't have anything for this new overall package as we're pulling this together today. If fiscal staff has anything they could add.
Mr. Mueller.
Madam Chair and Senator Dreheim, I will be requesting a new fiscal note on this bill as it is now engrossed if it is passed out of committee and over judiciary. I believe most of the previous fiscal notes had no cost to any state agencies. I know there was some raised about the county costs with the courts. Generally, the fiscal note would not try to calculate that cost. The fiscal notes usually just try to adjust costs to state agencies and whether there would be any additional costs there. So, like I said, I'll request a new fiscal note on this bill. And I think it would be, the cost would largely fall in the judiciary area if there were any that were to arise.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you for that, Mr. Mueller. And then I think a local impact would also be justified because this would raise the costs, I believe, in our local communities. And I hear time and time again, no mandates. And so I guess if this is going to move forward, Chairport, I think it's our due diligence to get that fiscal information and then maybe call it back into your committee and just go through the fiscal part of it before it moves to the floor if that's where you're planning to take it. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dreheim. Members, other questions? Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the author, I was just wondering, again, I asked this the other day about the definition of violent crime. Why is it that the crime has to take place against a tenant? I would think that a violent crime against anyone is a sign that any other tenants in the building might be at risk.
Senator Umover-Bayton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Housley, can you point me to the area in the bill that you're looking at?
It's in Section 12.
Senator Umover-Bayton.
Thank you. So this is language that comes from Senate File 2031, and that was originally Senator Muhammad's bill, so I may lean on her to also respond, but I think the intent here is to ensure that we are only addressing those scenarios that we feel folks are in danger. Senator Muhammad, is there anything you would add from that discussion?
Senator Muhammad?
Senator Housley, would you like to repeat your question?
Yes, so on line 7.28, the conduct would constitute a violent crime against another tenant. So my question is, why does the violent crime have to take place against another tenant when anybody committing a violent crime against anyone should, I would think if I were a tenant in that building and knowing somebody else was committing violent crimes would also put me at risk.
Senator Muhammad?
That's a good question. I think the word violent came from, it was a oral amendment by Senator Port, and I think initially said something along the lines of conduct. And I think, I see what you're saying, but plenty of people commit things that other people consider violent, and then some people may not consider it violent. I don't think any violent is okay against anybody, tenant or not. But when we're thinking about where somebody lives, per se, somebody was at a grocery shop got into a fight with somebody else, it got physical, should they be evicted from their home? Or should that be defined? And it should be the people that you live with, right? So like, as the landlord, your job is to keep your tenants safe. And if your tenants are committing crimes or harmful crimes towards other tenants, then I can understand some like serious actions that need to be taken. But if that individual doesn't live there, right? Like, we also have seen thousands of people say things about other people. People get evicted because of this all the time, and often it's not justified.
Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does the author consider a violent crime? Because there's a lot of things like mistreatment of residents or patients is not considered a violent crime. Financial exploitation is not considered a violent crime. Identity theft is not a violent crime. Labor trafficking or falsely reporting crime is not a violent crime. Killing or harming a public safety dog is not a public crime or a violent crime. So there's illegal possession of an explosive is not a violent crime. So is a tenant committing any of those protected under this bill?
I will go to Senator Umu-Verbaten, but I will flag that this was an amendment that we took to try to address concerns that were raised by the minority, and this is the language that Judiciary Council said is the appropriate language to have for the definitions, and I am certain they will have an in-depth discussion on it on when they hear the bill. But Senator Umu-Verbaten, do you have further thoughts on it?
Madam Chair, Senator Housley. Yes, so again, my understanding was you had a conversation about this in committee and wanting to ensure that there was that provision around violent crime. I believe Senator Lucero brought that up. You know, this language around other tenants, again, is really to ensure that we're focusing this on this, you know, space where folks are living together. We have a criminal justice system to you know, to handle crimes that are taking place in those other areas. If you do have concerns about other, you know, staff or employees, depending on where that where someone lives, I think that could be a good addition here. But again, we, you know, received this suggested language from Senate Counsel and Judiciary.
Senator Housley?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Umu-Verbaten. Did you say you would consider changing where the violent act took place?
Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Madam Chair, Senator Housley. So you mentioned if this is violent crime against another tenant, if someone is living in a situation where there are, you know, the landlord is present or there's like employees that are managing that space, I think that could be a good addition.
Senator Housley, follow up.
Okay. That's good. And where does this go next? To
Judiciary.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to be as quick as I can. Just several clarifying questions. I'll start with the housing assistance and the addition of that verbiage to the prohibition of discrimination. And so I am not familiar with this programs. I don't know the details. I have heard that there are inspections required. I've heard that there are other requirements of different units of government when entering into these contracts, and that's voluntary. Do you know, Madam Chair, does the author know, if now the state is requiring that people or housing providers accept tenants that are on these programs, therefore requiring the housing provider to enter into these mandates with these programs, do you know if those mandates will still be in place now that they're being forced upon the housing provider, or are those going to be done away with and not part of the condition of receiving rent on these programs?
Senator Umaverbaten.
Madam Chair, Senator Lucero. Again, I want to reiterate that this provision of the bill is about ensuring that folks cannot be discriminated against. You know, the issue, you've heard me say this, so I'm just going to reiterate. The issue is that folks are in their advertising saying that Section 8 should not even apply. That is discrimination, and to really clarify that, we're adding in that definition of participation in or requirements of a housing assistance program. And that is why it is in the human rights statute. I will also say that the Department of Human Rights, in addition to doing enforcement, does a lot of education and outreach to, because they don't want folks to get into these situations where they are discriminating against others. The landlords, the housing providers can go through their normal process of screening someone. They just can't use their participation in a housing assistance program as a reason to decide to not rent to them.
Senator Lucero, follow up.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate that, and I understood all that, but that wasn't, and I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm honest. I'm not trying to get, it's not a gotcha question. I genuinely don't have experience with these programs. Are there requirements for inspections or any other type of requirements that are mandated onto the units that will be expected if a housing provider accepts a check from one of these programs?
Hi, please introduce yourself and go ahead and answer the question.
Sure, I'm Ivory Taylor. I'm Associate Director with Housing Justice Center. You may have heard from Margaret, she had to step away. To answer that question is, yes, there may be requirements. Being a landlord is a choice, it is a business that's regulated, and just like when you move, certain cities have requirements for fire inspections yearly, and landlords have to agree to those, right? So it's similar in the fact that if you have a tenant that, when you screen, qualifies for your property, then you find out they have a Section 8 voucher, and that Section 8 voucher or some other program has an inspection requirement, it is no different than you also saying, as a landlord in the city, I understand you have an inspection requirement. That's a requirement of me to operate a business here. So it might be, yes. And it's a highly regulated industry, and it's a choice to be in it.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier then, what is the, so in that particular scenario, there may be others, but I appreciate that one example of a requirement if somebody is in this program, an inspection. So the city that I operate in right now does have a rental licensing. Not all cities have that, but the city I have rentals in does have that. And there are inspections that are required, but it's every 2 years. So, and I know who does the inspection. It's the city contracts with the third party, and they do the inspection. I know the time frame. I know how much it costs, et cetera. With these assistance programs, who performs the inspection? Who pays for that? And what's their time frame? And the reason those are the questions on top of my head is, if somebody, let's say I have a vacancy, it's an unexpected vacancy, and I've got, it's the 20th of the month, so I've got 10 days before the first of the month, and ideally I'm going to rent the unit out by the first of the month, right? And so if I advertise it, I open it up, I receive an application, somebody's on rental assistance program of some kind, and there's an inspection, I don't know what the turnaround is. So who's performing, how much does it cost, and who's paying for it?
Sure.
And
sure.
How long will it take?
Ms. Taylor.
Yeah, inspections have no cost to the landlord. They would be performed, if it's a Section 8 voucher, by the Public Housing Authority. And again, I don't know all the requirements of every single type of program. There are programs related to disability that Medicaid funds. There are programs related to Homework Starts at Home, which is, you know, a state program as well. I don't know all the requirements for those, but the programmatic, you know, holder of that program is the one that takes on the responsibility of completing those things. It should not have a cost to the landlord. I could not speak to the timeline for everything, but, you know, that is an education piece that landlords would take on so that they would be abiding by this law and not discriminating. And I think what this does is, yes, landlords will have to do some education, et cetera, but the outcome is that people are not being discriminated against. And so it seems like a fair trade-off. if that's the issue that we need to address. And having been somebody that grew up with housing assistance until very recently in my life, it is a problem. And so I think that that's what I would just keep in mind. But I think those are very good questions. It isn't a huge burden to the landlord, and they're not looking for every single thing. They're looking for basic safety things, just like a fire inspection does.
Senator Lucero, follow-up?
Thank you, and I'll move on to the next topic, but just final words on that is I, as a housing provider, don't have interest in accepting these checks from units of government, not because I'm motivated by discrimination against the prospective tenant or the person. It's I have a conscientious objection to the program. And so if I have an interest in not accepting a tenant on that program, it's not because of the person. It's for an entirely different reason. And what I see with this language is that I am now going to be categorized as discriminating against the person. No, it's an entirely different reason. It's a conscientious objection on something else. But one of the things that I'm seeing, and then when we heard one of the testifiers say, in the state of Minnesota, we have a one applicant at a time. I'm not familiar with other states, but it's my understanding that in other states, it's like a multiple offer situation when it comes to buying and selling, that a housing provider can accept multiple offers to lease the property, and then the housing provider can pick whatever one they want. In the state of Minnesota, that's not the case. I have to receive one at a time, make a decision before I could accept another. And I just see a lot of potential here for good people to get caught up and be told that they're discriminated against. And I do understand the intent. I absolutely do. You're modifying one side of that equation that I referenced on Friday. It's throwing the equation out of balance here without looking at the other side. And I'll just tell you, one scenario that might happen, and I don't know what these inspections entail, but it could entirely be the case where it would be a big waste of the applicant's time that if the housing provider knew of something that would cause an inspection to fail and made sure that was the case in their unit, and so the applicant would apply. The housing provider can't deny them, so they schedule the inspection comes out, the inspection fails, and then the housing provider can deny the applicant, I suppose, at that point because the inspection was denied or failed, and then therefore everybody's time has been wasted. And then the housing provider can move on to the next applicant because the inspection failed. And there's a whole host of other scenarios that I could, if I thought hard enough, I can come up with to get around this mandate, because this is not going to accomplish what you think it's going to accomplish. There are going to be ways around it. But let me move on to the next question here. And I'm really trying to go as fast as I can, and I appreciate the indulgence, Madam Chair. So the next one is on the line 5.12, prohibited fees. And I'm going to compare line 5.13 to line 13.10. So starting on 13.10, it says that, or it goes on to say, a specific accounting, there's a written notice of what needs to be supplied if performing an eviction based on non-payment of rent, and there has to be an enumeration of unpaid rents, late fees, and other charges under the lease. So I'm specifically drawing attention on line 13.10, that late fees have to be enumerated in the eviction attempt there for non-payment of rent. So then when I flip back to line 5.13, I'm seeing that except for actual services rendered. So my question, Madam Chair, is am I as a housing provider, if a tenant does not pay rent or they're late, I shouldn't say not pay rent, they're late on the rent, and then I charge a late fee, I'm not providing any service, I'm just simply charging them a penalty fee for late payment, but I'm not providing any actual service, am I permitted to charge a late fee?
Senator Umu Verbaten. Mr. McDonough.
Uh, Thank you, Senator Port, Senator Lucero. There is a separate statute, a more specific statute on late fees that does authorize them. And so in the canons of construction with statutes is the more specific statute trumps the more general one. So this does not impact late fees.
Senator Lucero.
Chair, if I
could. Senator Dreheim.
Could we get that statute?
Get it for you quickly.
Senator Lucero, can you move on to the next point while we look that up?
I appreciate that. While that's being looked up, I asked this question the other day, and I just want to get clarification again in this language before us. So would a pet fee, a non-refundable pet fee would be one example, and I'll put that out there. And then the other one would be, I right now have a provision on my lease that if I accept a tenant that has a pet, and I have a yard cleanup, you know, if they don't clean up the feces or whatever, I just charge a fee. I don't provide a service, and it's not a late penalty. It's just a fee for not having picked up the feces in a timely manner. Would that be permitted in this? Because I don't go out there and pick it up myself. I'm just charging them because they didn't pick it up, so I'm not rendering a service. Would that be permitted in this bill language?
Mr. McDonough.
Senator Port, Senator Lucero, I believe that would be permitted because the tenant is taking the option to not pick up the feces and the fee is being assessed on that. The tenant does pick up the feces, they're not assessed. And the late fee statute is 504B.177. 504B.177, enacted around 2010, I believe.
And then one last question on
Senator
this,
Lucero?
Madam Chair, is the pet fee, just for bringing, I advertise that I have a pet fee. So if a tenant, if an applicant, a prospective tenant wants to apply and they have a pet, I'm pet friendly, but there is that one time non-refundable, it's not a deposit, it's a fee. Would that be prohibited under this language?
Mr. McDonough or Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's not an issue because the landlord is advertising that fee and giving the tenant an accurate picture, right, of what the cost is of rent and any of those fees. What we're trying to avoid here is slapping on a fee after the fact that you have not advertised. So, yeah, there's folks that might not need to pay that fee because they don't have pets, and then there's some that may need to because they do, and that's, you know, that depends on who the tenant is, but you're being truthful about the cost of rent and any fees that may come along with it.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll conclude with this. I appreciate that. Would you be willing, I don't have language right now, but if that's the intent, and I agree with you, I'm 100% in agreement, have the knowledge up front, if it's advertised and somebody still willingly does it, that it should be a fair game. But the hidden fees, the stuff that wasn't part of the upfront, I'm fully in agreement that that should be prohibited. Would you be willing in a future iteration, I don't know, I'm not on judiciary, so I won't see it there. I don't have an amendment now, so I can't do it now. The next time I might see this, might not be until the floor. Would you be receptive to some kind of massaging that potentially deletes this for actual services rendered and replaces it with a prohibition of just being transparent? So allowing, empowering with transparency and to have the fee schedule or potential fees up front at the application process rather than afterwards. Because I'm concerned, and I agree with what your verbal expression was, but what your verbal expression was is not in here. It doesn't say anything about it being advertised or et cetera, et cetera. So would you be willing and open to maybe a floor amendment if that comes to that?
Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Madam Chair, Senator Lucero, let's talk about it. I am on judiciary. This is, of course, going there, but happy to continue to clarify this. I am going to ask Mr. McDonough to weigh in as well.
Mr. McDonough.
Thank you, Senator Port and Senator Lucero. Could you ask the question again? I got a little foggy for a moment.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there the two lines on the bill, or it's Section 7 of the bill. It's prohibiting fees except where there are actual services rendered. And I think that my example of a pet fee would be prohibited under this, because I'm not rendering a service, I'm just making it a requirement that they pay a pet fee up front. And so my question is, would there be openness or willingness to replace this section with perhaps a transparency of fees up front, so that a potential applicant, even before they apply, is aware of what fees would be there so that there are no hidden fees. Accomplishing the same goal, I think, but it would just be different language. Because, again, I'm thinking of the pet fee, but I'm sure there's other examples that could be come up with that would, the plain reading of the language, be prohibited.
Mr. McDonough.
Senator Port and Senator Lucero. Yeah, we could definitely look at, it seems like the language that's concerning you is the phrase optional service. And so perhaps we could look at something that clarifies that in a way to resolve your concerns. Because, again, the intention here is to not prohibit any of the things that you just mentioned. Okay? And like the other day, I think we had a conversation about convenience fees for paying rent. And the idea is if the tenant can avoid paying that convenience fee by paying a certain way, it wouldn't be covered. But if that was the only way they could pay, then it would be covered. So that's, so the concerns you're raising are the intention is to not include those. So if we could come up with something that maybe expands the phrase optional service, that would be consistent with the intent of the section.
Members, any final questions before we go to the author to close us out? Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Senator Port, and I just want to thank all the testifiers, all of the letters in our packets here, for and against. I appreciate that. And I think the explanation of 504B.177 is incomplete, and I do think after reading it here, there is some conflicts on the way it's drafted and what this statute says, and I don't think they're corrected. So I hope as this bill moves forward, which I hope it doesn't, but if it moves forward, it can be addressed at that time. We heard testimony that from one of the advocates that work in this field, helping people every day, doesn't know of all the programs. And now we're gonna expect all of our landlords, even the mom and pop renting out half their home, to know what all the programs are. And I think that's a terrible precedent when we're in a time of desperation on more units and more unit creation. We're gonna have the exact opposite effect with this bill. I think the comments about the first in line requirements are not addressed in this bill and are conflictive on what our landlords are supposed to do. And I think that needs to be addressed before it moves into judiciary. And then there is some, I think, misunderstanding on Section 8 and how that interacts with housing providers and the lease renewal. We heard earlier this year, members, about all the increases from housing providers on property tax, insurance, utilities, the cost of labor, and in some cases, the cost of security to try to protect the residents of those apartment buildings. When that happens, you have to offset that, and that is increasing the rent. And the way this bill's drafted, I think you will handcuff those housing providers to be able to have an increase like that without going through a lengthy process through the Section 8. So this is not ready for prime time. I would like to make a motion to table this bill, and we need to get it worked out before it goes on to another committee. So I would like to motion to lay Senate File 1298 on the table so we can work out these flaws if it is the chair's prerogative to move it forward. I do not think it's ready for judiciary. I think it needs more work. And just for the freshman members to understand, I have worked on housing issues since I came here. And I don't always have my caucus support. And sometimes it takes years to get bills passed, and I think this is one example where it will take time to get it done. So I offer the oral amendment to lay this on the table, or oral motion to lay it on the table.
Senator Dreheim moves to lay Senate File 1298 as amended on the table. That is a non-debatable motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. No. The motion does not prevail.
Division.
Yes for division. Show of hands.
Show of hands. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Or raise your hand. All opposed, raise your hand. The motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dreheim, I did just want to respond to one of the comments that you made around, and I don't know the exact scenario that you could be describing, but around those sort of a mom and pop renting out in regards to, you know, a tenant who might be using Section 8 and this source of income protection. Part of why we brought forth that A4 amendment that describes, you know, what this discrimination is that there is all, sort of a kind of exemption built into the human rights statute. So if you go to the A4 amendment and you look at line 3.7, it does state that the rental by a resident owner or occupier of a one-family accommodation of a room or rooms in the accommodation to another person or persons, that is, that the provisions above that do not apply in that scenario. So, you know, that's like you're renting a room in your house, right? And I don't know that I can cover that if I'm speaking to the scenario that you bring up, but that I just wanted to say that we thought really long and hard about that, and I know that there are folks from the Department of Human Rights here who could speak to it if you'd like, you know, greater explanation.
Chair, I was just going to ask for a roll call on it to put in the journal for
final passage. Roll call requested. Seeing three hands, roll call is granted. Senator Housley.
That was what I was going to do, too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just say thank you to Senator Umu-Verbaten and Senator Muhammad and Senator Ports and for everybody who has worked on this bill. It's a really good bill. It will make a difference in the lives of Minnesotans. I was a renter for a long time and recognize the value that the provisions in this bill have. So thank you for that. And with that, I would move Senate File 1298 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Senator, as amended. Senator Bolden moves Senate File 1298 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to Judiciary. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Port.
Aye.
Senator Bolden.
Aye.
Senator Dreheim.
No.
Senator Housley.
No.
Senator Lucero.
No.
Senator Muhammad.
Yes.
Senator Pa.
Aye.
Senator Rest.
With five yeses and three noes, Senate File 1298, as amended, is passed and moved to Judiciary. Congratulations, Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, there is no other business before us today. We will meet both Tuesday and Thursday next week. The lists of what will be heard both those days will go out this afternoon. And with that, we are adjourned.